This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will visit with Capital Watcher C.B. Forgotston, frequent blogger about Louisiana politics. He has some thoughts about what he deems as ethical lapses from former Congressman Rodney Alexander. We'll also talk with C.B. Forgotston about the latest move by Governor Jindal to perhaps put the gears in motion for a run for president in 2016. Also, American University history professor Peter Kuznick on the untold story of America in his collaboration with filmmaker Oliver Stone, and Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal with a compelling biography of Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington, one of the great musicians of the 20th century. Now the news on 89.3. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Today it appears that we will be unable to take your calls, so we ask that you email questions to inkstershow@wrkf.org until further notice. inkstershow@wrkf.org is the email address. Now, we, in the last few moments, have been able to make contact with our first guest, so we're in good shape as far as talking with him, and that's an honor, as always, as we greet C.B. Forgotston, the Capitol Watcher, former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee, and one of the most fervent and frequent bloggers in Louisiana. Good morning, C.B.
Morning, Jim. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with C.B. Forgotston. Now, you're up in arms about something that ran on 60 Minutes the other night. Tell us why.
Well, I don't know that I'm up in arms. It's just more Bobby Jindal's hypocrisy. 60 Minutes ran a piece, CBS TV 60 Minutes, ran a piece investigating members of Congress who have what are known as leadership PACs, and they apparently are living off of these political action committees that they get money from lobbyists and other people, and they can apparently spend the money any way they want. And one of the things that I found most interesting, I had no idea this was in the works, is that they dropped in on former congressman and current Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Rodney Alexander, and questioned him about paying his daughters $130,000 to assist in supposedly a campaign that really wasn't even a campaign. He won overwhelmingly, didn't even have a Democratic candidate. And when he was asked what exactly they did, his two daughters did in the campaign, he just said, whatever people do in campaigns. Just, it floored me, and then I started thinking, I'm saying, well, Bobby Jindal has made a lot of promises, and one of them was that nobody would be in his cabinet that wasn't ethical. And he said he would not have anybody that had questionable ethics, and that's exactly what 60 Minutes was questioning Rodney Alexander about, is having questionable ethics. And yet Jindal didn't do a thing about it. He did the same thing with Stephen Moray, who was actually fined for ethics violation, and he is a cabinet secretary, a secretary of economic development, and Jindal kept him on too. So it just bothers me about the hypocrisy of the Jindal administration.
Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you'd like to respond to CB's remarks. Now, $130,000 is what the Alexander children were paid. Two girls, is that?
Two girls.
Okay.
His daughters, and I think they have families and other things. And it was just a giveaway to me of, it was money that was intended for campaign things. It's just a giant loophole, and it's not necessarily illegal, and it's not something other congressmen don't do. It's just that I don't know of any other state where the governor says we're not going to have people of questionable ethics as cabinet secretaries, and then he turns around and appoints Rodney Alexander, who has questionable ethics,
well,
to the cabinet.
He didn't know about this. I presume the governor did not. When he made the appointment, he could rescind that appointment to Veterans Affairs for Congressman
Alexander. Well, I think he should if he's sincere about what he said. But at the same time, he knew about Stephen Moray's ethical lapses, and yet he appointed him to the Department of Economic Development.
Well,
so I'm just pointing out that our cabinet secretaries don't have a high regard for ethics, and our governor has even less regard for ethics, and he's supposed to be the ethics governor who brought us the gold standard of ethics.
All right. I'm already getting a few responses to you, CB, and you've been a frequent critic of the governor. Is this just another opportunity for you to pile on Governor Jindal?
No, it's an opportunity for me to talk about facts. And I have, you know, it's nothing new with governors. I have problems with a lot of governors. And it's hard to agree with any governor all the time. And so, but I try to make my disagreements based on facts, not anything else. I don't just say, well, I think Bobby Jindal, I just don't like him, and so I'm not going to support him. Well, I'm talking about specific things. I'm taking his own words and using them to say, well, why did you say that if you didn't mean it?
Well, here's the story. It says an investigation by Breitbart News Senior Editor-at-Large and Government Accountability Institute President Peter Schweizer found that former Representative Rodney Alexander, who won in Louisiana with 78% of the vote, paid his two daughters a total of $130,000 during the campaign cycle. Alexander, a six-term representative, retired from Congress in August to work in the cabinet of Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. You have commented that there's nothing illegal about this. If there's nothing illegal, is there anything that would apply as far as the ethics code?
Well, Bobby Jindal didn't say a violation of the ethics code. I read very carefully what he said. He said ethical. Now, 60 Minutes raised the question that this was not ethical, but it didn't violate the law. Now, when people talk about ethics, because I get questions from people all the time about things being right and wrong, and they're talking about morality and right and wrong, and that's the sense that I read Bobby Jindal's statement. He didn't say if they violate the ethics law. And in case of Stephen Moray, he did violate the ethics law, and he still didn't do anything about him. So, I've tried to base what I say on facts. And, you know, if the facts hurt, so be it. But I don't just go around and say, well, I don't like him just because I just don't like him. I have a reason. I base my comments and criticism on issues, mm-hmm. not personalities.
Well, the governor did say in his inaugural address, his first one, January 14th, 2008, when he was introduced by Tim Brando, former student at Northeast Louisiana University, left without getting a degree, but he was there to introduce Governor Bobby Jindal, who said he would promote the gold standard of ethics in Louisiana. That was his major focus in his inaugural address. And some supporters say he's done exactly that. Obviously, you disagree.
Yeah, I think he gutted ethics. I don't think there may be a gold standard on paper, but it's totally unenforceable because of setting up two separate systems that work against each other. He has a group of administrative law judges that basically the governor appoints, and then he appoints another group to send cases to the law judges, and they can't seem to work together. And so I think that ethics law is worse than it's ever been. Now, on paper, it may be good, but it's always been a problem with the administration, and he just made it more problematic by two with his creation of the gold standard.
Now, I think Stephen Moray, who you mentioned a few times, has done a nice job as Secretary of Economic Development. What was his ethical lapse?
He failed to disclose the fact that he was a lobbyist, failed to file his form registering as a lobbyist. I think that's a pretty serious thing. And that was back when he worked for the Baton Rouge Chamber of Commerce. And he clearly was. Not only was he clear, but he had to pay a fine. And yet Jindal appointed him anyway.
Well, now, I think those listening might say, look, Morey's thing was just an oversight. Now, what Alexander did is a different story. Actually,
Morey's was worse because the law is very clear, and ignorance of the law is no just oversight. What Rodney Alexander was taking advantage of a law that he and the other congressmen passed to enrich his family.
Okay, well, Rodney Alexander.
I mean, one is an actual violation of the ethics law and the lobbyist registration. The other is an ethical violation in terms of right and wrong.
Well, there is a pattern involving former Congressman Alexander. He was elected as a Democrat. The Democratic Party went full bore in getting him over the top against Lee Fletcher. He beat him by about 100 votes. And then Congressman Alexander switched parties. Some people have problems with that, CB.
I don't blame them because I don't know what a person stands for when they do things like that. I mean, clearly he switched parties. Alexander switched parties to the Republican Party because he couldn't get elected as a Democrat again. And, that was his decision, and the people reelected him as a Republican.
He won re-election, and now he's left office for this position as head of Veterans Affairs, and you have alleged that it benefits him financially to do this.
Yeah, he has until his last day in office to rejoin the state retirement system and buy back all of his time at the rate that he would have paid at the time, and I'm talking about going back to when he was a state legislator. He buys that back at a very low rate because his salary was probably $30,000 at that time. So he can buy back in, get all the accumulated time, but his salary, his retirement benefits, will be calculated on the basis of $130,000 that he's currently making. So I fully expect him to take advantage of that and get a retirement that's probably bigger than his federal retirement, which he also will get, and he will get Social Security retirement, as well as his wife's retirement. She worked for the state also.
Here's a question from Neil, who wants to know how much it costs the state of Louisiana to have a special election, now two elections, as a result of Congressman Alexander's retirement from Congress.
Well, that's a great question. According to the Secretary of State's office, it cost an extra $2.7 million, which the Secretary of State was not appropriated for in the current year's budget. And so, to my knowledge, they still hadn't found out where the money's coming from. Obviously, it will just come out of the Secretary of State's normal budget, but that means he will be $2.7 million short to do the normal functions of the Secretary of State's office. I think that was a pretty expensive election when you consider how few people went to vote.
And a congressional term is only 2 years, and this would apply to Richard Baker, who did exactly the same thing. It would seem that if somebody runs for re-election and gets a two-year term, they can suck it up and stay the 2 years and wait and hope they still have a job waiting for them when that term is over. I think a legitimate question has been raised by you as to whether this is an ethical approach to be elected for a two-year term and then leave in the middle of it.
I think it's a violation of your commitment to the public. When you run for a two-year term, and then to turn around and stop in the middle of it. In Baker's case, I don't recall. You may recall whether it required a special election.
It did.
It did.
Don Cashew.
So
won.
I assume it cost that. So it's a double whammy. I think they've breached their contract with the voters, and I think it's something we ought to pay very close attention to. And I think that Alexander in particular is egregious because there was a deal cut.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Capital Watcher C.B. Forgotston, pride of Newellton, longtime resident of New Orleans, now situated in Hammond, where he opines about Louisiana politics at Forgotston.com, a former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee. Before we get back to the deal that you allege that was cut involving Congressman Alexander leaving the U.S. House, Terry Ryder emails saying, Morey's violation was not a statute in the state ethics code, Title 42. It was a different statute, lobbying laws in Title 24 or 49. Does that matter, CB?
Well, it doesn't matter, but I appreciate Terry correcting it. He's right. It is supervised by the Ethics Commission, though, and they're the ones that find him.
What about
I consider it an ethical violation. You could say it was a criminal violation or something if you wanted to, because he was fined. But I prefer to say it was an ethical violation.
All right. Well, this deal that you allege was cut, I don't think there's any proof, but there's some suspicion that
there's a lot of circumstantial evidence
about what happened.
About Rodney Alexander's sudden departure and costing us $2.7 million. And his own staff told me that he did tell them that he was going to retire, but at the end of the term, and that therefore the staff didn't need to worry. They had a year and a half to find a job or whatever time it was when he first discussed this summer with his staff. Then suddenly, within the next day, after he had made this announcement, the next day, without even telling his staff, he said he was taking the job with the as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. So either he lied to his staff initially, or there was suddenly a deal cut. Because a lot of people say, well, it's in the works for a long time, because Neil Reiser had been wanting to be a congressman for a long time. No, that's not how it played out as far as the staff. In fact, Alexander's staff didn't find out about him quitting near the end of September until they got a call from one of the D.C. lobbyists saying, what's this about? And so that was something he just did with the help of Timmy Teeple, Bobby Jindal, and Neil Reiser, and they quickly put this deal together. And frankly, at the time, I'm saying, wow, that was a pretty slick deal. Looked like Neil Reiser's a shoe-in for the congressional seat. And it was a slick deal, but that's not the right way to do business and deny the people an opportunity to have a vote. Not only did he do that, but Jindal called the election very quickly. It was like 60 days between the time we first heard that Rodney was retiring and there was going to be an election for his replacement. And that's not much time to run a congressional race, and it was set up for Neil Reiser.
Well, Reiser's he's in a runoff with a business person, Vance McAllister. Looks like it'll be a tough race, but Reiser has the establishment behind him. He's from the great town of Columbia. Go ahead.
I have a different take on this. I think that it's McAllister, Vance McAllister, a newcomer in politics, race to lose, because you're exactly right. I mean, Neil Reiser had the establishment behind him. He had the establishment Republican Party. He had Bobby Jindal. He has Bobby Jindal's closest advisor as his campaign advisor. I mean, he had the Jindal money and everything, but he barely got 32% of the vote. So 68% of the people said, we don't like the establishment doing this to us and costing us $2.7 million. And so I think if McAllister just runs a straightforward campaign and keeps telling us who he is and what his plans are, I think it's his to lose. Now, being a newcomer, it's possible for him to lose it. But I can tell you, Neil Reiser's camp is very worried, and they went on the attack immediately after the campaign. And when you're on the attack, it means you're losing, even if you were the front runner.
Well, Reiser is from Columbia, the town that produced John and Fox McKithen, Buddy Caldwell, and probably a few other Louisiana politicos that don't immediately come to mind. Population 477. Must be something in the water in Columbia.
It is, and they've had successful politicians from up there. But I don't think this is that kind of case. And, you know, it's been a long time since we elected a governor from North Louisiana.
Well, this is for a
congressional
seat.
And, yes, we did elect an attorney general from North Louisiana. But actually, Buddy Caldwell is from Tallulah.
He is now. But I think he actually was born.
Oh, is that right?
I think he was born in Columbia. I think so.
Oh, okay.
But another story, front page of The Advocate today, a state lawmaker is calling for an end to the Tulane Legislative Scholarship Program. You think that's a good idea?
I think it's an excellent idea. I just think that it is totally abused, and there are people that could use a Tulane scholarship, and if you're going to have them, I frankly think that they're totally unnecessary as long as you're going to have politicians giving them out. It serves no useful purpose. The money would be better if the state wants to give money to Tulane, they ought to just give it to them in a direct appropriation, which the state does in various other ways. They'd give money to the Tulane Medical School and other functions. The only reason to have these Tulane scholarships is purely patronage for the legislators and the mayor of New Orleans. There's no other purpose for it other than patronage. And you're talking about giving a student, if you give them a four-year ride, we're talking about $160,000. That's a hell of a lot of patronage mm-hmm. for a state legislator to give away.
Well, I know of cases where students have gone undergraduate and then to law school on one of these Tulane scholarships.
Yep. And so we're talking about big money here that a single legislator has the ability to direct $160,000 in benefits to a single individual or family. And I just think that there's no good that can come of that. If a scholarship should be based strictly on merit or whatever the basis for it, and there's no basis for this other than patronage by legislators, and that's why it's going to be hard to get rid of. And I admire Senator Dan Clater for even trying, because I can't wait to see the legislators' arguments for why they need to give the scholarship money. There's just no purpose for that other than to say, well, that's the way we've always done it.
Another inquiry from a listener asking your opinion of the acknowledgement by Governor Jindal that he's considering a run for president in 2016.
It may be the only time he's told the truth about it instead of just saying, I have the job I always wanted. The problem is this time, at this point, he may be considering it, but he's got no shot. And I think that's why he's setting up this policy group, is to put himself in the position to have a business once he's no longer governor.
He could run for the U.S. Senate next year.
He could. But I'm going to tell you what, if you look at the latest polls, I think he would be the person that Mary Landrieu would like most. But also then, and of course this wouldn't be a big hurdle for him, remember he promised to serve his whole 4 years. We just talked about how Rodney Alexander and Richard Baker breached that contract with the public.
Well, it's a bit different when you get elected to another office, isn't it? I mean, Buddy Romer left.
No,
Buddy Romer
when
left Congress
say,
early.
when you say, I have committed to run for governor for 4 years. He didn't commit, I'll be governor for 3 years and then Jay Darden can be governor for 1 year. No, he specifically said, I will stay in office as governor for 4 years, for the whole term. He made that pledge right after he got reelected.
Well, it'll
again, that's no hurdle for Bobby Jindal. He generally says one thing and does another. So it would be consistent for him to do that. But frankly, I don't think he'd have a prayer against Mary Landry.
Oh, you don't really believe that, do you?
I really believe that. I believe that Bobby Jindal is poison in this state. I don't think he could get 20% of the vote.
Oh, come on now. Come on. He could get 20%. He could get 20% if he were caught in bed with a live girl and a dead boy.
Well, you're right, because 20% of the people would probably just go and vote for the name they recognize. But in any case, I mean, what would it do to get 49%? And he can't get 49%. And so what's the use of running and losing? How does that benefit his future aspirations?
Well,
but that isn't going to happen. We can speculate about that, just like we can speculate about him being the Republican candidate for president in 2016. That just isn't going to happen.
Well, people have underestimated him before.
And well, I understand that, but, you know, I'll stick by this message until I'm proved otherwise.
All right, CB, always nice to talk with you, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
And that's forgotston.com to find out more about Charlton Bath for Godston. Tomorrow on this show, we are slated to have in-house to talk with us Carl Bernstein, the internationally famous and decorated reporter who helped break the Watergate story wide open with his colleague Bob Woodward. And as I was thinking about the interview today, Watergate, as we know, was in 1972. So that's 41 years, and the time between Watergate and the present is equal to the time between Herbert Hoover and Watergate when the break-in occurred on June 17th, 1972. So it's a long time, but it remains one of the pivotal moments in United States history. Carl Bernstein coming as part of the centennial celebration for the LSU School of Mass Communication. And as one writer noted this week, the LSU Journalism School was founded in 1913, and that was also the year of birth of Richard Milhouse Nixon, and he's the man who went down and resigned on August 9th, 1974, from the presidency, and it probably would not have happened, at least not that quickly, without the intrepid reporting of Mr. Bernstein and Mr. Woodward. Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you'd like to pose a question online. And we're now joined by Peter Kuznick. He is a professor at American University and is a fascinating man. Good morning, Professor Kuznick.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you. And you have collaborated on a best-selling book with Oliver Stone that's now a multimedia presentation, and you also teach a course called Oliver Stone's America.
Yeah, I've been teaching that since 1996.
What is taught in Oliver Stone's America at American University?
I use Oliver's movies to frame a debate about interpretations of American history. So we start with JFK to get at the late 50s and 60s, we work our way all the way through to the present. So we've got his three Vietnam movies. We've got his movie Nixon, as you were just talking about. We've got the Doors movie to talk about the 60s counterculture. Salvador is about U.S. intervention in Central America and supporting right-wing extremist elements there during the Reagan period. The two Wall Street movies. His movie W about the Bush administration. You can look at all the different periods. What we do is we compare Oliver's interpretations with the works by scholars on those different periods, and then we also bring in a lot of guest speakers who were involved in those events, some of whom have passed away since I started teaching the course in 1996, but we have most of those on recorded so we can at least show their presentations to class.
Well, this.
So it's really we're doing is comparing interpretations mostly. And now we have my own, you know, my project with Oliver, The Untold History of the United States. So the problem is now that we've run out of time. In 1996, we could fit it all into one semester. Now I've really got to pick and choose what things we can cover.
Well, tell us about The Untold History of the United States. That's the purpose, the primary purpose of our visit today. Now a paperback and, as I said, a multimedia presentation, and you and Mr. Stone, who served valiantly in Vietnam. You have collaborated on a venture in which you muse about what was not reported that was instrumental in the formation of the country as we know it today.
Yeah, well, what we had was a 10-part documentary film series that aired on Showtime Network in the United States and then it aired around the world. And then we just released the DVD box set this past week, and that has 12 episodes, two that we didn't have time to show on television. And it starts with really the 1890s and works its way up to Obama's reelection in 2012. So we're covering that over 100 years, really about 115, 120 years, and it's a history of the American empire and national security state. And basically what we're challenging is this notion of American exceptionalism, the idea that was stated so eloquently by Woodrow Wilson when he said after Versailles that now the world will know America as the savior of the world. And so we're tracing that idea in its various permutations and offering an alternative view of America. We acknowledge that the United States has done a lot of wonderful things over the past 100 years, but we argue that there are libraries full of books praising the United States. What we're trying to do is show the other face of America, the dark side, you know, all the places where the United States went wrong, in the hopes that by shining a light on the mistakes that the United States has made, we can avoid those in the future, and the United States can really live up more to what Oliver and I see as this promise.
Well, as I noted about Mr. Stone, he's a guy who fought in Vietnam, who served with distinction when others who became presidents and vice presidents chose to cut and run during that time. Why is he taking aim at his country now in this way? You're saying there's an altruistic motive here, but some would question that.
Well, Oliver, as you were saying, dropped out of Yale in order to volunteer for infantry in Vietnam. He was actually in the same class at Yale as George W. Bush. But unlike Bush, Oliver actually wanted to act on his beliefs. He grew up in a very conservative Republican family. He supported Goldwater in 1964. Even after serving in Vietnam, he still hadn't become radicalized. In 1980, he voted for Ronald Reagan.
All right, we'll hold that thought and return with Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and collaborator with Oliver Stone on The Untold History of America, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Peter Kuznick, associate professor of history at American University and collaborator with filmmaker Oliver Stone on The Untold History of America, which is a look at the dark side of American history. And we're going to get to some of the darker moments, according to Professor Kuznick. But what about Stone, who in 1980 voted for Ronald Wilson Reagan for president? What happened to him along the way?
Oliver served in Vietnam. He was wounded twice. He was highly decorated, came back, and took some time to figure things out. In the 80s, he went down to Central America in preparation for his film Salvador, and that's when his views started to change, when he saw what the United States was doing in countries like Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua. He began to question U.S. foreign policy. And if you watch his films, you see his ideas evolving gradually over the next period. He and I had talked about doing a project together back in 1996 when our friendship began, when he first came into a class that I was teaching. But we never were able to quite get that going. But in late 2007, he was scouting locations for his movie Pinkville, which was about the My Lai massacre, and he was in Washington. We had dinner, and we decided then we were going to do a documentary. It turned out to be a 10-part, 12-part documentary film series, so it was a project that took us 5 years. But the idea was, this was late 2007, we were both totally disgusted with the Bush presidency, with the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and we decided we were going to do a shorter project at that point, but then we decided it made more sense to look at the full scope of American policy, and so we decided to do that, and we trace it beginning with 1898 and the U.S. intervention, the U.S. Spanish-American War, and the U.S. at that point changes. The United States was a country born in revolution, a country that often supported progressive revolutionary causes around the world. That begins to really change in the 1890s. In the United States invasion of the Philippines is an important turning point where we're opposing the popular forces of Aguinaldo, and we send a force, an army there to overthrow a popular democratically elected government. And that begins a process of U.S. interventions throughout Latin America, especially over the next 30 years, country after country after country. We're sending the Marines into over and over again. S. Medley Butler, the most highly decorated Marine in the United States, said, I went into one country after another, this country for the National Bank Boys, this country for Brown Brothers Harriman. I became a gangster for capitalism. I was there defending the interests of American business and overthrowing government after government. But that becomes more pronounced after World War II. And so a narrative that we see as the one that students have to learn starts with the overthrowing of the Mossadegh government in Iran in 1953, looks at the overthrowing of the popular government in Guatemala in 1954, and then especially in the 1960s. For example, when we treat Vietnam, our Vietnam episode does not look at Vietnam in isolation, because then you can think of Vietnam as an aberration. But we look at the overthrow of the Brazilian government in 1964, the U.S. sending the Marines into the Dominican Republic in 1965, the bloodbath in Indonesia in 1965, the overthrow of the Allende government in Chile in 1974. If you put Vietnam in that context, you see Vietnam differently, not as something that was a terrible mistake. But even this question of Vietnam as a terrible mistake is being rethought now. Last year, President Obama announced a 13-year campaign to commemorate Vietnam, to rethink it, to emphasize what a noble cause it really was, and that it was representing America's attempt to achieve its highest ideals. And we find that to be obscene.
Obscene? Coming, obscene, yeah. You say?
Obscene, yeah.
All right.
This is
well,
a war. Let me explain. I ask my students often, how many Americans died in the Vietnam War. Some of them know that 58,000 Americans died. There are actually 58,272 names on the Vietnam Memorial Wall. And then I ask them how many Vietnamese died in the war. The estimates usually range from about a quarter of a million up to a million. Sometimes somebody will know a little bit more than that. I tell them when Robert McNamara, who was really the architect of that war, came into class, he said that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in the war. That to me is appalling, but it's reflective of the kind of ignorance, historical ignorance, that Americans have about their own atrocities. The Vietnam Memorial is now 146 feet long, with the names of 58,272 Americans who died. If that memorial, and the message of that memorial is the tragedy of Vietnam is that 58,000 Americans died. That is tragic. That is horribly tragic. But if that memorial contained the names of all the Vietnamese, all the Laotians, all the Cambodians, everybody else, including the Americans who died, that would not be 146 feet long. It would be over 4 miles long. That, to me, would be a war memorial. That would have a message about the tragedy of Vietnam or the criminality of Vietnam, whatever you want to call it. If you go to Okinawa, Oliver and I were in Okinawa this summer. We visited the Okinawa War Memorial. That contains the names of all the Americans, all the Japanese, all the Okinawans, all the Brits, all the Aussies, everybody who died. That, to me, is a fitting tribute to what that war was about. I think if we had a four-mile-long Vietnam memorial, that would be a fitting burial place for this notion of American exceptionalism.
Well, Professor Kuznick, you're an interesting man, and we look forward to talking with you again, and congrats on your fascinating collaboration. I know many are probably shaking their heads, and others are nodding in agreement as they hear your words about the untold history of the United States. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Jim. Anytime.
My pleasure. Talk soon. And we'll move to a happier note here in just a moment. Duke Ellington, the great American musician born in Washington, D.C. in 1899, the year of birth of Humphrey Bogart. He lived until 1974, and he did his thing like few others, if anybody else. And Terry Teachout, the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, has written a remarkable book about Edward Kennedy, Duke Ellington, Duke, the life of Duke Ellington. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
Well, Duke Ellington is a man who's been gone almost 40 years, but I hear his name almost every day, and I don't run in jazz circles every day. He is a big part of our culture.
He's still very much with us because his music is with us. Even people who don't know Ellington's name, they know Mood Indigo. They know Sophisticated Lady. So they really know who he is.
How did you develop your fascination with him?
Well, it goes back to my father's record collection, actually. He was a big band buff, and when I got into the basement closet that had all the old 78s, I discovered Ellington, and I became a jazz musician myself. And for anybody who plays jazz, Ellington is going to be part of the center of their life, and so it stayed with me ever since.
Well, those of us from Louisiana think of New Orleans as the cradle of jazz, and it probably is, but Mr. Ellington came from another part of the United States.
He came from Washington, D.C., which is not the cradle of jazz. Came from a very respectable middle-class family, didn't really find out about jazz until he got into high school, and then he heard a jazz and ragtime piano player, and that was what did it. Suddenly, music, which had just been something in the background for him, moved decisively into the foreground.
Well, how important a composer was he?
He's the most important jazz composer of the 20th century, and I think one of the most important composers in any genre. Somebody that you really should be mentioning in the same breath that you mention somebody like Stravinsky or Prokofiev. He's that significant.
And why?
The center of it, I think, is that Ellington was the first jazz composer to use instrumental color in the same way that the great classical composers do. This wasn't a major factor in early jazz. And although there were big bands before Duke Ellington, they didn't sound like Ellington. He had that uncanny ear for color, and he had that uncanny ability to use the abilities, the sounds, the inspirations of his hand-picked musicians. That was the key to what Billy Strayhorn called the Ellington effect.
Now, you have written a book, another well-received book, about Louis Armstrong, Pops.
Yes.
How do you compare these two men?
Well, they are the great bookends of jazz in the 20th century. But beyond being black jazz musicians, they really don't have anything in common personally. Armstrong is I don't need to tell anybody from Louisiana about Louis Armstrong. You know, comes from the roughest block in New Orleans. His mother was a prostitute. And he grew up to be a completely open and accessible personality. I talked to a lot of people who knew Armstrong. They all loved him. Ellington is much more opaque, much more private. Doesn't want to give away the secrets either of his private life or of his musical life. And so he develops this elaborately polished, circumlocutious manner that he uses to keep the world at arm's length.
Well, what kind of a person was Duke Ellington? There are legendary reports about his nocturnal pursuits. Was he a good...
There's nothing legendary about those reports. Ellington was one of the great lovers. He liked them hot, heavy, and in large numbers throughout his life. And it wasn't just, you know, an obsession. It was that he found the company of women and the act of sexual intercourse to be directly inspiring to him as a composer. He wrote a beautiful ballad once called Warm Valley. I'll just say that that's not a geographical reference.
Did he have a particular type?
No. As a matter of fact, it was all over the map. And once a friend of his saw him going off for the evening with a woman who just wasn't attractive at all. And the next day he said to him, Duke, what was all that about? And he says, man, we've all got to dig a little distortion once in a while.
Dig a little distortion.
Yeah. That's an authentic quote.
Well, he was a generous man in many ways, wasn't he?
Yes. Generous to family, very open-handed. But his generosity was always on his own terms. And he could be very stingy sometimes when it came to matters of credit, professional credit. He liked people to think that he wrote all those songs all by himself, and sometimes he did, and sometimes he didn't. There are many unacknowledged collaborations or insufficiently acknowledged collaborations with members of the band. That's, I would have to say, the most unattractive side of his personality. It's something he has in common with Orson Welles, who did the same thing with Citizen Kane. He wanted you to think that he was the magician who did it all without assistance. And he was a great genius, but that's not true.
We're visiting with Terry Teachout, the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal. Previously, he wrote the bestseller Pops, The Life of Louis Armstrong, and now he's back with A Vengeance with Duke, The Life of Duke Ellington from Gotham Books. It is quite a story about Edward Kennedy, Duke Ellington. Now, Duke lived from 1899 to 1974. That was not a great time in United States history as far as race relations, and he was fully aware of the issues with race in this country, and he thought of himself in a way that perhaps African Americans, some, might not appreciate. Why was he not in the vanguard of civil rights?
Well, he was in the beginning. I mean, he really saw himself as a symbol of racial pride and was perceived that way in the 30s and 40s. But when the civil rights movement began to change shape and became more politically aggressive, Ellington was not a political man. He thought that the best way for blacks to improve their lot was not by protest, but to be very blunt, this is really what he thought, you know, by making large amounts of money and essentially buying their way into respectability, becoming businessmen and people that whites simply couldn't ignore. And that was an old-fashioned perspective, and it was one that didn't sit well with a lot of blacks in the 60s. So that became an issue later in his life.
Well, you note that he saw himself as a member of light-skinned black bourgeoisie, an elegant,
yes,
cultivated gentleman.
He was born into the black middle class in Washington, D.C., and the respectability and the manners that he imbibed from earliest childhood were central to his image and to his self-understanding.
Was he affected at all by discrimination?
Oh, good heavens, yes. But he always endeavored to rise above it, and if I can say that, to use it creatively, and I'll give you an example. When he toured the Deep South in the 30s, at a time when there weren't hotels that would admit blacks, you know, there were like black motels or black boarding houses. It was strictly second and third rate travel. What the Ellington Band did was hire private Pullman cars and travel there and sleep on the cars and eat on the cars. And this was just unheard of for a black band to do this kind of thing. So people would come and they'd see the Ellington coming in and the Ellington Band coming in its private car. And they'd say, well, Duke, what about this? And he'd say, well, that's the way the president travels. And that made a very powerful statement of the kind he liked to make.
He even won a Pulitzer Prize for his work, posthumously.
He won it posthumously, but he was up for it during his lifetime and was passed over. And it was one of the most embarrassing and humiliating episodes of his life. The The Pulitzer then was given only to classical music, and the Pulitzer judges thought, well, there's no piece that deserves it. So they recommended to the Pulitzer board that year that Ellington be given a special citation for the totality of his work. Board turned him down flat. The news got out. It became a story. And a reporter called up Ellington. He was out on the road somewhere. Said, Duke, what do you think of this? And Ellington said, didn't bat an eye. He said, fate is being kind to me. Fate doesn't want me to be too famous too young. But that was his public reaction. In private, he was enraged.
All right. We're short on time, but Terry, a listener, Tracy, wants to know how Duke got the scar on his face.
His wife gave it to him when she found out he was catting around with other women. She cut him with a razor in bed one night.
That's all in the book, Duke.
It sure is.
A Life of Duke Ellington, Music and Beyond, from Terry Teachout of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.